Welcome to Inside Track. Santa Aurelia LLC is solely responsible for its content and pays for it. The views and opinions expressed on Inside Track are those of the host and guests and not necessarily endorsed by KVOI or its advertisers, but they should be. And now here's Bruce Ash.
Hello, Insiders, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you wherever you may be. This is your host, Bruce Ash, welcoming you to a special 9/11 Remembrance Edition of Inside Track. Eb's on assignment today, and I'll be sharing some of my thoughts on what 9/11 means to us 19 years later. We'll also be speaking with Laura Reese from the Heritage Foundation on the continued violence here in America, in our streets, and its impact on our urban landscapes and to civil order. I'll also be speaking to CD1 Republican nominee Tiffany Shedd, who shares her thoughts on everything from tax increases to healthy forests. Completing our show today is friend of the show, Jean Fettigan from Sister Jose Women's Shelter. She's a great lady. With all the focus on the Wuhan virus, we sometimes forget how vulnerable the homeless are. Sister Jose is a great resource for helping women rise from homelessness. So listen up. We have another great show for you today on Inside Track. As always, thank you so much for supporting our great Inside Track sponsors, Jamie and Gary Kipper from Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, Gary Imus and my co-host Eb Wilkinson with Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, and those kids from Corazon Cabinets, Joy, Allie, and David. They're all great local companies you should do business with. I do, and I encourage you to do so also. Do you have a home improvement project you want to get started on this summer, but are worried if you can afford the luxury you deserve? Corazon Cabinets sells quality J&K, Conestoga, Yorktown, and Waypoint cabinets. Plus, Corazon Cabinets offers professional design resources for your home. Call Corazon Cabinets at 488-2266 and schedule a visit to the showroom. It's an easy number, 488-2266. Hey, Corazon is moving their showroom in October, so watch for some even greater specials over the next month on their quality products for your home. When you do call, tell Joy, Allie, or David you heard this ad with Bruce on Inside Track and get an additional discount on their already low wholesale prices. Friends, as we remember on this day in 2001, our world was rocked, and according to many, life changed across the globe forever. Two jetliners smacked into the World Trade Towers, one plane crashed into the Pentagon, and another augured into a Pennsylvania farm. For a brief moment in time, we were united as a country, Democrats and Republicans arm in arm. Remember singing America the Beautiful on the Capitol steps? Americans panicked but resolute. Our president declaring, "The people who knocked the buildings down will hear us soon." We recall the young man in the red bandana, Wells Crowther, who saved so many lives in the tower that morning only to lose his own life a short time later when the building collapsed, burying him and so many other innocent victims as well as our first responders. We also recall that our country was heard from, and what seemed to be vengeance against terrorism turned into nation building, rendition camps, and an endless war which still lingers. Far more young men and women killed to preserve order in the world than killed that morning in the towers. And for what? Peace in Western Asia and the Middle East has been elusive, despite recent successes by President Trump and his team with the United Arab Emirates and a brokered peace between Kosovo and Serbia, plus diplomatic recognitions for Israel. A nation is supposed to learn from its mistakes, but what have we learned? Many political and military people in leadership are still pushing wars we cannot win and should not fight, mainly because this is what their so-called expertise is in. These experts have a vested personal interest in continuing the war drums, and they have caused us great pain while they personally prosper. A new and unlikely American president has stood up to the military-industrial establishment, and they have been fighting back as hard as they can. This president, Donald Trump, believes America should be well prepared for war, but so well prepared that no one would dare to attack us again. He knows, some in the military and the Congress know, and I personally know, the real threat in the world today is not the Wuhan virus or ISIS. The real Satan in the world is communist China. They are hegemons. They are human rights abusers. They are aggressive to their neighbors, both politically and economically. They cheat in business, and they lie, as has been seen, how they lied about the virus to the world while they saved their own people. They misled the world, and hundreds of thousands who have perished to the virus are the early casualty in China's war of aggression to gain worldwide superiority. The Uyghurs are to this Satan just as the Jews were to Hitler, like the Tibet country who is dominated by communist China. The communist leadership seeks to eliminate the Uyghurs. In parallel, China has broken the 50-year agreement with the British Crown to effectively turn Hong Kong into a politically enslaved colony. Now they have turned their sights on the independent nation and people of Taiwan. The communist Chinese government's Belt and Road economic policy seeks to enslave third world countries with debt that allows the Chinese to get their hands on their country's natural resources. And they're building military bases throughout the world, now even extending to the coast of South America. While the United States and our allies are distracted with China's Wuhan virus threat, China continues aggression, both militarily and economically, across the world. Friends, the dragon in the middle of the living room in this year's elections is China. Biden has even bragged that China wants him to win. Here in Arizona, Senate candidate, gun grabber, baby killer, and China collaborator Mark Kelly has way too many financial ties to China. In order for America and the free world to never be dominated by the communist Chinese dictator, we must continue to build our nation's strength and the strength of our allies, both politically, economically, and militarily, so we never have to go to war with them. This will never happen if Joe Biden or Mark Kelly is elected. If history is any indicator, keeping America free and strong will not be the goal of a Biden-Harris administration, and China will continue to dominate economically. They will continue to be a threat to world peace and human rights. I'm pleased to welcome a new guest to Inside Track. Laura Reese is a senior research fellow for Homeland Security at the Heritage Foundation. We like heritage and the good work you and fellow scholars do there, Laura. Over 23 years experience in immigration and Homeland Security, Laura Reese twice worked at the Department of Homeland Security on management and immigration policy and operations issues, most recently as the acting deputy chief of staff. Laura's commentary and analysis have been published and quoted in The National Interest, FoxNews.com, Roll Call, and The Hill. She's been interviewed by Bloomberg, CNN, Washington Monthly, and the John Whitmer Radio Show, and now she can brag she appeared on Inside Track. She's even appeared before Congress. Reese earned a law degree at Valparaiso University Law School in Indiana and studied Mexican law as a visiting law student with the University of Houston Law Center in Mexico City, Mexico. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you, Bruce, for having me.
Sure. You recently wrote an opinion piece for the Detroit News, and it also appeared in the Daily Signal titled Portland's Endless Riots Are Destroying Lives and Businesses. You wrote, quote, "These endless riots are not saving black lives. They are destroying lives. They're destroying businesses. They're rendering the social fabric of an entire city." Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, if you look at Portland, for example, riots have been going on there for over 100 nights now, and that's the most glaring example. But it has spread to many cities. Last night, Los Angeles was starting to flare up with rioters, and it's in part because the local politicians have turned a blind eye to this. They've been very permissive. And if there aren't consequences for prosecuting these laws that are broken and arresting these people and charging them with crimes, they're just let back out into the street and they commit riots again the next night. Mm-hmm. So it's spreading and it's escalating.
So as you said, these violent protests have gone for over 100 straight nights. So besides violence against persons and damage to property, what's been actually accomplished by this protest?
Good question. While Black Lives Matter might say there's more awareness on by corporations and professional athletes and celebrities, that seems very superficial. It's form over substance. And really, these groups like Black Lives Matter and Antifa have been quite vocal about their aims. And it's more than just awareness. They're looking to change our systems in the U.S., whether it's more than just, you know, defunding the police or changing the criminal system. It's really headed towards a socialist society.
So I'm sure you would agree with me that police brutality is wrong. Do Black Lives Matter and Antifa, I think you've maybe answered this question, but do they seriously care about Black lives? And if they do care, is this the right way to go about it?
Well, that's obviously their name, and they seem to be selective. You know, I don't see them protesting outside Planned Parenthood, for example, where many Black babies are killed. I would say it's difficult, I think, for them to point to success here. Hmm. Other than if they measure success by wreaking havoc and keeping this going perhaps till the election, then they might view themselves successful. But in terms of truly helping Black lives, I don't see where they can point to any success.
So I've tried to gear our interview so it doesn't sound as though it's overtly political or partisan, but the work that these groups are doing really is political, and it's very partisan, and it does involve the election here in just less than 60 days, doesn't it?
Yes. Their crimes are very organized. I mean, the mere fact that Portland has been going on for over 100 nights shows you how organized this is. And the weapons that they bring and the cachet of shields, for example. So they are well organized and they are well funded. And this is something that needs more exposure in terms of who is funding them. But as I said before, a lot of the local politicians and even national politicians are only recently giving kind of tepid lip service against violence in general. But many of the politicians won't even name these groups. And if you're not going to name them, how are you going to fight them?
Mm-hmm. With riots and killings, the answer by many Democrat-run cities is defunding police. Why? You write that 79% of Americans polled in battleground states are against defunding local police. What will the likely outcome be from defunding or disarming police departments across the country?
We're seeing it. It's going to be more violence and more crime. Crime is going up in so many cities across the country, and that is a direct result of defunding police. Many police are resigning or retiring early. Yesterday, the Rochester, New York police leadership announced that they were all resigning. This isn't going to end well. And until politicians and even individuals are affected personally, many of the leaders don't tend to act. And it's very unfortunate.
Hmm. So when I read articles online, I generally go a bit further to read comments. There were many comments on your piece that appeared actually in the Daily Signal. Some unrepeatable here, but I thought that this excerpt was compelling. This respondent said, "It's sickening to me that a politician can decide basically who lives and who dies just for the political narrative." Wheeler said on August 6th, this is the Portland mayor, Mayor Wheeler said on August 6th, "When you commit arson with an accelerant in an attempt to burn down a building that is occupied by people who you have intentionally trapped inside, you're not demonstrating, you're attempting to commit murder." Well, it's now September well, the first week of September, and you have to ask, when is that enough for Ted Wheeler, the writer says. Our governor, Kate Brown, is equally responsible. Let's ask those same property owners, business owners, and residents their feelings now. So what is the mood in Portland and in other cities that have been rocked by violence to these violent protests that have occurred?
Well, I think some people are voting with their feet and moving out of Portland. But even in that instance you mentioned about Mayor Wheeler and the arson in his very building, he was then going to move out of his building to one of his other homes. Where does that leave his fellow residents and his constituents in that building? Not to mention all the other citizens in the city of Portland who he took an oath to protect and
right.
defend.
Right.
It's truly a dereliction of duty by these leaders. With respect to Governor Brown there, she had talked about bringing the state police back into Portland to finally help quell this violence. And many of the sheriffs from around Oregon said, no thanks, we are not going back to Portland because the prosecutor there won't prosecute these the people who we arrest for these crimes. They just let them back out onto the street, and they're back rioting again the next night. So we'll stay in our respective counties where prosecuting for crimes is still a priority. Mm.
So I have a very close associate who's lived and worked in Washington, D.C. for almost 20 years. He and his wife, who's a consultant for a major firm there with two children, have decided to pull up roots from D.C. and move from there, the city they love, to rural Virginia out in Loudoun County to seek refuge from the violence. So what impact does violence have on long-term urban viability, and what about the urban decay that we're seeing in major cities across the country?
Yeah, I have several colleagues who have said the same thing about moving out of D.C. And what it does is it leaves empty buildings behind, fewer businesses, a smaller tax base, and a place where people aren't going to want to come and visit. So, you know, losing tourism dollars as well. It won't be a thriving city with, you know, families developing and going to school and running businesses. And it's sad to see.
New York Governor Cuomo has not requested federal law enforcement assistance in spite of a considerable amount of violence there. To quell violence in his state, but he has been begging for federal dollars to bail his state out. Just this week, he said, people are leaving New York City due to crime, homelessness, quality of life, so why is Cuomo and other Democrat mayors and governors like him more scared, it seems, of Antifa and the BLM and the far left of their own party than violence on the streets?
It's a great question. You wonder what some of these organizations are saying behind closed doors to these leaders and to professional sports organizations and to Hollywood members to then get the lip service and the support that these groups get from these leaders. And the point you make about Governor Cuomo asking for more money but not federal help is the exact opposite. And the three ways some of these leaders are only seem to be affected is if they are personally affected by crime and riots, if it affects their power or threatens their power, or their pocketbook. And so the president announced this week that he's going to look at where federal dollars are going. And if they're going to these cities that won't prosecute for crime or won't quell these riots, he's going to withhold federal money.
The Democrat presidential nominee, you write, has been straddling the issue, and he says that the federal government has a right and duty to protect federal property, but he's also said federal troops would sow chaos and division. So what are voters to take away from this sort of waffling from the presidential nominee?
It's leading from behind. Joe Biden likes to tout at times that he's been strong on crime in the past. He has been vice president, so he knows that there is a duty for federal officers to protect federal property and the people inside them. On the other hand, he seems to have moved far to the left and is not naming Antifa. He's not naming Black Lives Matter. So he's just kind of giving a lukewarm response to the violence that's going on. But it doesn't bode well for strong leadership and to not only stop such violence, but prevent it from happening in the first place. Mm.
You say leniency toward rioting, looting, and violence ensures that such activity continues, spreads, and escalates. Americans want the opposite: safety, open businesses, and thriving communities. My dad taught me, if you refuse to stand up to bullies, Laura, they will keep making life miserable. What happens if elected leaders fail to hear the serious concerns of those that elected them to protect, versus these outsiders who sow violence and chaos?
I think Portland is the perfect example, and contrast it with Kenosha and Milwaukee, where leaders there did ask for federal help. And when the National Guard went in, the riots quickly stopped. So it is a good example of what happens when the violence is permitted to continue versus where more protection is brought in and the violence will stop.
Well, Laura, thanks for appearing on Inside Track. I think our listeners are going to enjoy your perspective. And our listeners can follow you in the good work you do at Heritage. And your last name is spelled R-I-E-S. And if they Google Heritage Foundation, they're going to be able to find you and read your articles.
Thank you very much, Bruce.
All right. Thank you very much, Laura. Talk to you again down the road. Stay tuned to Inside Track. We'll be right back. I'm proud to welcome my good friends at Tucson Iron and Metal Retail to Inside Track as an advertiser. Jamie Kipper and her staff are conservation experts. They sell round and square steel tubing, metal plate and roofing materials, as well as new and used steel, aluminum, and stainless steel to ranchers, artists, interior designers, roofers, and do-it-yourselfers, just like all of the listeners here. Tucson Iron and Metal Retail is open Monday through Fridays, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., and Saturdays, 8 a.m. to noon. Tucson Iron and Steel Retail, 701 East 36th Street. Call 520-209-1576 or go to TucsonIronRetail.com. And when you do call, mention this ad and receive an additional 10% discount on their already great prices.
I'm Eb Wilkinson with Imus Wilkinson Investment Management. I don't ever want you to be dependent on government ever again. I want you to become financially independent. You will never, ever have to depend on socialist security for your survival. We are here to guide you to financial independence. That's imuswilkinson.com, 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
Welcome back to Inside Track. Our guest for the next several minutes is Tiffany Shedd. Tiffany is a farmer, a rancher from rural Arizona, and she is running for CD1 U.S. House. She's in a very tough race with that guy who's been there for a while and nobody ever sees him, especially down here in southern Arizona, so I'm not going to give him any credit. Tiffany, welcome to Inside Track.
Thank you, Bruce. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Yeah, you've been pretty busy. I know you actually do travel into the southern part of the district here in Pima and in Pinal County, but you've been all over the district, haven't you?
Yeah, actually, we were in Pima County last night for my daughter's birthday. She's a resident of Pima County, which wasn't campaign related, but happy birthday, Summer Grace. And we were in Apache County last week, Coconino County, and I live in Pinal. So we've been all over, and it's really important. And it's funny, you said you haven't seen our current congressman in the South. Well, nobody's seen him from what I've heard in the North either, northern part of the district. So they're upset too.
Yeah, the House is supposed to be the branch of government that is to have the closest amount of contact with the people, It sort of defeats the purpose when you don't make yourself very accessible to the people.
True. And, you know, in a district like CD1, there's so many federal issues that are overarching, but there each area has its own problems or issues with the federal government. And some of the worst are even on a more localized basis of constituent services that people need and have to travel a really long way to even get to a congressional office in CD1.
Yeah. So your opponent is part of a Democratic caucus who has committed to raise taxes $4 trillion on working families and small businesses. He wants to cancel the Trump tax plan, which has added millions of jobs and success for small business owners. What is your plan on taxes and creating more jobs, higher wages, and creating greater wealth?
Well, and I think that is the key. If we can get government out of the way and let the American people, you know, do what they do best, which is build the economy, invent things, pursue the American dream, they will. And, you know, my opponent voted against the Trump tax plan, which was put our economy in a great place before this black swan event of COVID. But to top it off, which even just makes it worse, and thank goodness we have a Senate that wouldn't pass it, he also voted during this pandemic for tax breaks for California and New York millionaires with the SALT tax that was part of the HEROES Act. And so, you know, the Trump tax plan saved the average American Arizona family $1,800 a year. Voted no on that, but voted, you know, to make sure that if you have, you know, millions of dollars of property in New York and California, you got that break. And the hypocrisy of that bothers me. But, you know, I'm a small business owner. I've been a small business owner for 30 years. I've been farming since 1989. We also own a car wash, a golf cart storage business, U-Haul distributorship, and that's my husband and I. And, you know, you realize as a small business owner, every layer of taxes, every layer of compliance with taxes and compliance with regulations, not even just the cost of the regulations, but having to pay CPAs and figure this stuff out, just makes it that much harder to stay in business or to risk starting a new business. And so, you know, government really does affect, you know, especially our small and our large businesses, our large corporate businesses, of whether they can, the risk reward is there. And so, you know, when you need that money for capital, for payroll, to try something new, the last thing you want to be doing is writing a giant check to the federal government.
Hmm. You know, Tiffany, $1,800 to the average family isn't chump change. That's what Nancy Pelosi called it. It's not chump change. I mean, that potentially is gasoline for the family for the entire year. It pays most of the utility bills for many, many households here in Arizona for the entire year. It is, braces on the kids. I mean, it is a family vacation. It's all of those things. I mean, $1,800 is a big deal. The current congressman from CD1 votes against it, Trump tax cuts, and then gives a SALT deduction, which is a huge, it could be hundreds of thousands of dollars to rich guys. Now, look, I like to think of myself as not exactly, you know, unrich or unpoor. I mean, all of that is good, but oh my goodness, I mean, that's just insensitive to the voters in CD1.
It absolutely is. And, you know, I think we also need to remember that $1,800 isn't a stimulus check or an entitlement. This is money people have earned with their paychecks that is going to the federal government to pay for, you know, all kinds of crazy project runaway spending, etc. This isn't money they didn't have. This money should have been in their pocket. They earned it. Those families earned it.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, you hear, well, it saved $1,800, but it is a lot of money for a lot of families. It makes the difference, you know, on education, et cetera. I mean, I don't know what world, well, I do know what world Nancy Pelosi's living in, but I can guarantee you living in rural Arizona, that makes a huge difference in a lot of families.
Yeah. So talking about rural Arizona for a moment, and you know, I'm so glad that John Kyle, who probably has been one of the greatest champions for rural Arizona, for water rights, for conservation, supports you. And it totally makes sense to me. This year, the wildfire season has destroyed hundreds of thousands of acres in Arizona alone. You're in the agriculture business. How does poor forest management under Democrat leadership hurt Arizona farmers and ranchers? And what's your answer as a conservator? You know, you're a conservative, but that means that you want to conserve to help create the sort of healthy forest that were meant to be under federal law.
Well, the thing is, we do know how to be good stewards and how to conserve our forests. We have some of the best science in, you know, what they call range management, land management. The problem is the federal government isn't the best at doing it in the first place. And secondly, we've got this little law called Sue and Settle that stops projects that, you know, clear biomass, that do things that would prevent these catastrophic fires. And that being said, Senator Kyle is a mentor of mine. He is a statesman. And we do see eye to eye on that if we don't take care of our land and our water, everything else becomes a bit irrelevant in Arizona.
Yeah.
And you know, as in agriculture, you know, one of the things people don't realize is when you do have catastrophic fires, and this isn't just agriculture, this is anyone getting water from any river system, whether it be SRP, CAP, that, you know, fires decrease water quality because you've got all that ash and whatnot coming down the watersheds. If you've got, don't have fires and you have out of control undergrowth and biomass, it takes more water than it should and reduces the amount of water we have to use for other things in the state. Additionally, the ranch community has gotten hit incredibly hard in Arizona. And, you know, they're one of the people that are stewards with their federal leases. You know, they've got cattle grazing that are reducing biomass. It's part of the range management system. And when these fires come through, people don't realize they've invested, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars on tank systems, on, you know, pipes. And a lot of the water systems they put in for the cattle are also what your deer, your elk, your wildlife drink from. And when those are destroyed, they're left holding the bag of all of a sudden having to replace these things. And this infrastructure falls literally to that rancher. And I know that in Marana, they did a huge cattle sale at the Marana Stockyards trying to raise charity money for these ranchers that have literally been wiped out through federal leases and wildfires. But it didn't even touch it. It wasn't even close. And so, you know, when we don't put the, you know, Tom O'Halloran voted against increased wildfire prevention on federal land. He also voted against reducing regulation that would allow commercial logging industry to help with removing what causes the catastrophic fires. He voted against, so, you know, there's two votes that could have saved acreage over time, but he voted against them. And, you know, the thing about the wildfire prevention, and I don't want to be a big spender, but it is the federal job to conserve our federal land, is that what are the costs on this side? We've lost tourism. Houses have burned. We've lost businesses. No one wants to go to Flagstaff and or Sedona or wherever if it's full of smoke. I mean, right now, out my window, we have an overcast of smoke from the California wildfires clear to Arizona with this weird sun going on. And so these things affect agriculture. They affect every part of water, land management. They affect, you know, our urban folks as well, our businesses, our economy. It's just one more thing we didn't need and we shouldn't have, but we've had years of mismanagement, sue and settle, and frankly, he should have been out there advocating full-throated for wildfire prevention measures before, you know, it's too late and they've already burned. And so this just breaks my heart, you know, even Pima County, it's horrible fires this year. And so it's all over our state. And I don't think that that's a good way to manage our forests, is to just let it burn.
Well, Tiffany, there were lots of other questions I wanted to ask you today, but we're up against the clock. Thanks for coming and chatting with us. And the next time we talk, we will talk about the big, beautiful wall that's being built and how that's helping protect Arizonans and all Americans. But until then, we'll end it here and wish you well on your campaign. And listeners, stay tuned. We'll be right back after some commercial messages. You're listening to Inside Track. Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. What other kind of customers do you have?
So our biggest customers are actually like ranchers and people from outside of the Tucson area. They're buying a lot of square tubing. They're buying a lot of stuff for their ranch to close off fences.
We'll sell anything from 10 feet to 10,000 feet to somebody that comes in because we have new steel and surplus steel from steel mills. The reason we're able to get such good pricing on some of this stuff is, A, we sell scrap to the mill. So we have a relationship there, and then we can buy material, what they're making, bringing it back. And so we save on freight, and we have relationships for years with them. So I think that's really our niche market. We'll sell whatever you need.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
Wouldn't it be great if political leaders could create that country again? Learn how to do exactly that, one family at a time, with Imus Wilkinson Investment Management. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, imuswilkinson.com, 777-1911, 777-1911.
We'll finish up the show today with old friend of the show. She is a wonderful, well, she's not old that way. She's just an old friend of ours, Jean Fettigan from Sister Jose Women's Shelter here in Tucson. For those of you who haven't met Jean and don't know much about Sister Jose, this is a wonderful, wonderful organization that myself and my wife support, and I hope you will after hearing from Jean today. Jean, welcome to Inside Track. It's been a long time since you've been on the show. You've had a very interesting 2020, haven't you?
We have, right along with everyone else. Thank you for inviting me this morning.
Of course.
So when we started, you know, life changed as it has changed for everyone. And for the homeless, we went from being able to serve about 100 women a day who come into our center and get something to eat. They can take a shower, they can do one load of laundry, and most importantly, they rest. They worked with agencies to help them find ways to move forward. That stopped, and almost overnight. And so we were in a panic going, how can we help these women and also keep our volunteers safe? We have wonderful volunteers. I had, at the beginning of the pandemic, about 250 active volunteers. Most of us are over 65. Some of us have health issues, and so that number, Bruce, dropped to about 30. So what could I do with that? We immediately turned the table around in front of the door, demanded everybody mask. We went to disinfectants. We have done everything we can do, and we began to serve food at the door. Couldn't let them in, but I could hand them a mask. I could teach about the virus, teach about them and what they should be watching for on the streets. For those that were really ill, could we find a way to get them into, you know, the city, county had started the hotels at that point. So we began to try to work and get some of the most at-risk people into the hotels. So a whole new process started. And we served at the door and sent word out to the community that we needed top cans of food because we didn't have that. That's what we started serving, so that at least the people on the street could have something to eat and know that we're still here, know that we still care. So education then went to how to stay healthy, how to stay away from people, what are the guidelines, are you sick, have you been around anybody who's sick, that sort of thing. We did that for a couple of months or so, 3 months maybe, and then we started very slowly, as the rules relaxed, began to say, how can we go to the next step? The next step was allowing a few women in at a time to take a shower, to do a load of laundry, and to get a bite to eat. So that was the next stage. And we could have, you know, I took all the chairs out of our little dining room and spaced them 6 feet apart and, you know, made sure that everyone was masked. We began to see more volunteers slowly returning. We just went to the next stage. We've done that for a couple of months. Then this past, in July, we started a very small cooling center. We have a big congregate sleeping area that we had to close. So we took blue tape. If you came to visit me, you'd see big squares in our congregate sleeping area. And we've placed mats on the floor. We give them a sheet, you know, something to sleep on. And we allow them to come in as a cooling center for part of the day, and then we still are closed at night.
So the women don't have a place to sleep at night. Unfortunately,
not right now. Oh, we don't, which is awful. So my goal, and we are waiting for the county to provide contracts. We have been awarded a contract through the county to expand a bit of our storage area in back so that I can get back to 35 beds. I can hire shelter monitors at night because most of my volunteers are older. And I want to do that so that I can get the night open as soon as I can get that expansion done. And we can begin to bring in at least the same number we had before, which was 35 women at night, and really began to work with those women and rebuilding program. Agencies have not been able to come in. We do contact agency, you know, to try to get women help who are members of that agency. We're also working on trying to find good case management that can be here to help the women as they come in.
Jean, what challenges have you had dealing with city and county officials and perhaps Pima County Health Department in terms of how you are able to operate even on this limited basis?
You know, honestly, Bruce, they have been very kind, very good. The county listened very closely when I applied for those grants. They have listened to us. They've taken into account the issues they had. When all of this started, I immediately contacted the health department and said, I'm a congregate living. I can't, you know, bring good people in. I need to try to quarantine what I have and get them out. So that's what we did. Worked with them. They've been quite nice. They have helped. I hope that the health department will provide flu shots. We need to get started on those and do some clinics here so that the people on the street are protected, at least for that. County and city have both been very responsive. I've worked with both Councilman Fimbres and Steve Kajacek to, you know, in this area to try to work together and make sure that We're doing what we can to help the people that we can.
And how about,
it's difficult right now.
And how about volunteers? Have your volunteers been coming back slowly? What's the status on that?
Yeah, they have. I've probably up to 40.
Oh, that's
45
great.
45 volunteers. So everybody, you know, we aren't doing the night program, so everybody's coming in. This morning I have a volunteer who will be back in our cooling area. The beds are made. They're ready. The mats, I should say, are made. I've got a volunteer there. I will have two volunteers still at the door for the women who don't want to come in but need something. They need clothing. They need emergency clothing, or they need hygiene, or they whatever they need. Boy, we try to serve everybody. For those that are coming in, when I'm through with an interview, I'm going to go out. I take everybody's temperature. I make sure everybody has a mask. I talk to every person saying, are you okay? Same question. Have you been ill? Have you been around? If there's any, I can't get a good temperature on someone, they're running a fever, then I direct them toward, health care to try to get them taken care of. And that's what we do, and the volunteers fall in. I have a great kitchen crew.
So let's talk about some of the professionals that in normal times were able to work with the women in terms of helping them get back to some normalcy in their lives from different agencies and so on around town. How is the sort of advice and advocacy being handled today in the middle of all of this?
I think it's really hard. So it's done by phone. El Rio has been a great partner. They have continued to come in on Tuesdays for us. Although they do it by phone, they at least are checking in with us. They're trying to stay right with their clientele to make sure they're okay. A couple of the other agencies are available by phone. No one is willing to send agencies as they were in the past here to the center. That's a huge problem, but at least we have phone numbers. We do make phone calls, and we do try to help the women that way.
So the other big thing in our final minute or so that we have together,
sure.
It's about money. I mean, all of this doesn't happen just, it doesn't come out of thin air. It's about people supporting Sister Jose. I know that you've got a virtual event coming up. Tell our listeners something about that and how they can help.
Well, today are sending out invitations on the website. It will come up in the next day or two. You can buy tickets. You can participate in a virtual event. You know, in the past, we've all been able to gather several hundred of us in an area that is not available to us. And so what we will do is a silent auction. We have a great silent auction going right now. You're right, Bruce. It's all about sustainability and whether or not we can keep going. And so this virtual event will help us to do that. It is on October 24th. You'll be able to find all of that information on our website. And I'm so excited. It will be our first time to do a virtual event. I expect to see you there, Bruce Ash.
I'm count on Janie and I being there. We've already said that we're going to support you financially again this year. We made a gift in the winter and doing it again now. Friends, this Sister Jose is one of the really foundations in our community that helps those people who really are having a tough time in their life and trying to bring some normalcy back to it. And Jean, thanks very much for everything you do. We're up against it. We're going to have to close for today. And thanks everybody for listening to Inside Track. Thanks to our guests, Jean Fettigan, Laura Reese from Heritage, Tiffany Shedd, candidate for CD1. Until next week, this is Bruce Ash wishing you all a very pleasant good afternoon.
Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus.
A lot of the cities and the counties around have initiatives for artists. I think we're one of the premier artist suppliers for steel. First Saturday of every month, you can come down early and actually go through the scrapyard across the street. It's 7 acres of metal. You can walk through with our people and pick out what you want. It's always interesting to see what the artists have done. We've done actually a couple projects with the U of A Engineering Department and Music Department, where the engineering music students came down together. They had to pick something out of the scrap, and they had to build an instrument. And we have one of those in front of the plant. Some really cool things come out of the scrap.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street, open Monday through Saturday.